Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and review the selling of the Surge this week on Capitol Hill. We'll be joined by Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who in addition to his combat service in Korea and Vietnam, General Gard's military assignments included Executive Assistant to the Secretary of Defense. He was the first Director of Human Resource Development for the United States Army and was a Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. He also served as President of the National Defense University and was a Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is currently a Senior Military Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. And he'll be joining he'll be joined with Colonel E.W. Bill Chamberlain, who is a fourth-generation American military professional, a West Point graduate. He retired in 2002 as a highly decorated full colonel after 30 years of service in the United States Army. He was commander of Task Force Stryker during Desert Storm and as the Inspector General of Central Command under General Anthony Zinni from 1998 to 2000, gained a broad familiarity with the Middle East. Colonel Chamberlain has contributed commentary and analysis on strategic and military affairs to the Chicago Tribune and elsewhere. His recent novel is Operation Desert Vengeance, and his forthcoming book is Tripwire, set in contemporary Korea. Then we'll talk about the other war with Robert Young Pelton, who is an author, filmmaker, and journalist. His most recent book is License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, now out in paperback, and he's currently co-founder and owner of IraqSlogger.com, a 24/7 news service from Iraq. Robert Young Pelton is just back from Afghanistan, where back at the time of the American invasion, he discovered the American Taliban, John Walker Lind. And then we'll speak with John Dean, who before becoming counsel to the President of the United States in July of 1970 at age 31, John Dean was the chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and the Associate Director of the Law Reform Commission and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. He served as Richard Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days. He's the author of 8 books in total, including the bestsellers Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, and Conservatives Without a Conscience. His latest book is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches, the third book in that trilogy, which we'll be discussing along with who will be the next Attorney General. I'm now speaking with Lieutenant General Robert Gard, who, in addition to combat service in Korea and Vietnam, General Gard's military assignments included Executive Assistant to the Secretary of Defense. He was the first Director of Human Resource Development for the United States Army and a Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. He also served as the President of the National Defense University and was a Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's currently the Senior Military Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C., and he'll be joined by Colonel E.W. Bill Chamberlain, who retired from the United States Army after 30 years of infantry service as a full colonel in 2002. He comes from a family which has for 4 generations served this country as professional soldiers in the United States Army. Colonel Chamberlain graduated from West Point in 1972, commencing a career which earned many medals and commendations, including the Combat Infantryman's Badge, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Distinguished Service Medal. Colonel Chamberlain served as the commander of Task Force Stryker during Desert Storm and as the commander of the 3rd Brigade's combat team, the 4th Infantry Division, and as the Inspector General of Central Command under General Anthony Zinni from 1998 to 2000. Following his retirement, he served as a consultant to the Army on future combat systems and leadership development. An avid student of military history, Colonel Chamberlain has contributed commentary and analysis on strategic and military affairs to the Chicago Tribune and elsewhere. His recent novel is entitled Operation Desert Vengeance, and he's just completed Tripwire, a novel set in contemporary Korea. And he's currently working on a non-fiction book entitled State of the Union. And gentlemen, let's begin with General Gard. This week, obviously, the Surge was sold to some extent on Capitol Hill, in spite of the evidence that this year, in fact, has been the worst year for Iraqi casualties and the worst year for U.S. and coalition casualties. If you believe that the Surge was successfully sold, how did they get away with it?
You mean how does the administration get away with continuing the?
Well, now let me ask you one. Do you think that General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker successfully sold the surge? And if so, how?
Well, I think they probably bought time for the president. But I have to say that it's a bit late now at this stage to start employing appropriate counterinsurgency tactics after 4 years of employing the wrong tactics, which killed tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians and destroyed a good deal of the infrastructure and alienated the population. So then we told Petraeus, look, go get your troops shot at so you can buy some breathing space for the government to make political accommodation. And of course, there was no political accommodation. In fact, a poll taken by ABC, BBC, and a Japanese broadcasting company that was published on the 10th of September revealed that 65% to 70% of the Iraqi population believed that the surge worsened the security situation and set back political accommodation and reconstruction. That's hardly a success story.
And Colonel Chamberlain, do you believe that the surge was successfully sold on Capitol Hill? And if so, how, given the evidence to the contrary?
I think, Ian, the only people that bought the surge were those who were inclined to do so to begin with. I think Senator Warner was very specific. He asked General Petraeus a question. He said, hey, can you tell me that what you're doing in Iraq is making America safer? And Petraeus started tap dancing, literally, and said, well, you know, we're meeting our objectives in Iraq. And the senator said, that's not the question. Is what is going on in Iraq making America safer? And the general finally said, and I quote, sir, I do not know, actually. And that's the whole point. If we're not there to make America safer, why are we there? So again, anybody that bought the surge is working rationales and numbers and PowerPoint charts and all the rest of the garbage that was thrown out there wanted to believe it to begin with. I saw the same survey that General Guard's talking about, and the president, you know, he talked about Anbar province and what a success it is. 100% of those surveyed in Anbar province said, we don't want the Americans here. 100% of those surveyed in Anbar province agreed that attacks on coalition forces, to include the Americans, were okay. It didn't mind. It's all right. We don't mind. Yeah, go ahead and kill the Americans. That's not a success.
Well, is it possible, though, that this change of tactics, where the Sunni are being either armed or encouraged by the United States, is in fact, I believe this, that the Sunni made this offer a couple of years ago and President Bush rejected it, although the British urged him to take it up. It seems to me that maybe what it underlies is in fact a recognition that this has become and is a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and that it's a de facto recognition on the part of the Sunni and on the United States that they've in fact been fighting the wrong enemy. Let me begin with General Gard.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. Clearly, we failed to do the job in Afghanistan. We allowed Osama to escape from Tora Bora, and we had him bottled up. We refused to provide the commander on the ground with a Ranger battalion to block the Tora Bora exits. We're paying the price for that now. And, of course, as the National Intelligence Estimate has said, Al-Qaeda Central has reconstituted itself and has the ability now to plan major attacks against the American homeland. Meanwhile, we got ourselves involved in a quagmire in a country that posed no threat to the United States. So it does seem to me that, and of course, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq until we went in as occupying troops and provided the motivation for people to affiliate themselves with al-Qaeda, calling themselves al-Qaeda in Iraq. There is also the additional risk that in arming the tribes in Anbar, you are preparing them to continue the civil war with the Shia. If and when we leave, the Shia government's very nervous about what we're doing there.
Well, let me ask you, Colonel Chamberlain, do you see this as phase two? There's a lot of chatter, as they say, about an attack on Iran. It seems to me that the switch to backing the people that have been shooting us has more to do with the fact that the people who have been shooting at us want to shoot at the people who run the government.
Well, we need to be clear on the point that everybody's shooting at us. I mean, we're in the middle and we're getting shot by Shia and Sunni alike. When I wrote that article for the Chicago Tribune 2 years ago predicting what was going to happen in Iraq, and sad to say all of it's happening, I said then that we were going to have to arm the Sunni or we are going to be a party to, historically, of being accused of having gotten them slaughtered by the Shia when we leave. So arming them was something that was going to happen. That and the point that, as the general pointed out, the real two protagonists over there are the Saudis and the Iranians. And the Sunni are with the Saudis, the Shia are with the Iranians, and we cannot afford, because we've already tipped the balance, arming the Sunni is a slight way, and it won't be lasting, to put it back together again. More interesting is what General Gard was talking about, Tora Bora and where al-Qaeda really is. I know the Democrats are working hard to put together a bill that says, hey, you got to give the troops at least a year at home before they go back. And you and I have talked about that before. That year at home is not a year at home. That's a year of training to go back. I think Democrats ought to put a bill together that says, hey, we want to withdraw from Iraq and go after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I think the president would be real hard-pressed to say no. That's not a good idea to finally go after the guy that started all this instead of screwing around in a backwater.
Interesting.
I second the motion.
Well, let's hope somebody's listening at the White House, but I wouldn't hold my breath. But just, Colonel Chamberlain, do you accept the notion, I think you do, it's implied by what you said, that it's really a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran? And if so, how do you contain a proxy war and stop it from becoming a regional war?
Well, they have had this bone of contention, the Shia and the Sunni, for 1,400 years, so to say that it'll become a regional war, I'm not sure that's going to happen. But you know how you contain the whole thing is there's nothing in the Middle East that we care about or anybody else cares about other than the folks that live there except oil. And you know, and instead of trying to hold neighborhoods in Baghdad that we're successful temporarily as long as we're in that neighborhood, the insurgents move elsewhere, kill more people elsewhere. We move over there to take care of that while they move back to where we just left. So we're fixing nothing. But, why are we sitting in Baghdad? The only thing over there worth anything is oil. I would sit on a damn oil field, and I would tell the Iraqis, you're not getting your oil back from me until you guys get your act together.
General Gard, what do you think of that suggestion?
Well, I'm certainly for pressuring the Iraqi government to try to come to some sort of accommodation so they quit killing each other. We can't stop a civil war with our troops. All we can do, as the colonel commented, was a temporary tactical success in those areas of Baghdad in which we placed our troops. But the whole problem from the beginning is that we went in with too few troops, none of them trained in counterinsurgency operations. We employed conventional war tactics, banged down doors, did search and kill or capture operations, and in the process have so alienated the population as a whole that, as was noted earlier, even in Anbar, where they're temporarily cooperating with us, they don't want us there. There was a poll a couple of months ago done by, I believe it was ABC and USA Today. 97% of the Sunnis and 83% of the Shia oppose the presence of U.S. combat troops. Now, Petraeus, who oversaw the rewriting of the manual, understands that the real purpose, if you're fighting an insurgency, is to protect the population and to isolate it from the insurgents. But the problem is he doesn't have enough troops. As was just said, he moves into some areas of Baghdad, and the insurgents move into another area. Had we gone in with 500,000 men, as we had in Gulf One, trained in counterinsurgency, stopped the looting from the outset to prevent anarchy in the society, we might have had a chance, but I still don't think we would be successful.
Well, obviously you would never overcome the strategic blunder of rewarding Iran by taking away the country that held it in check, but it does violate everything about the Powell Doctrine, and it makes you wonder why General Powell was so acquiescent. But just in terms of one of the jobs that you held, General Gard, it's as the first Director of Human Resource Development for the United States Army. How do you feel about the state of the Army? Because I understand that that's really what's at issue here with most of the military people, and there may, in fact, be a conflict between General Fallon and Admiral Fallon and General Petraeus over the... I mean, the idea that they're going to have to pull people out in the spring is inevitable, is it? And you've also got over 1,000 waivers have been issued to recruit people with felony records.
Yes, well, I don't think there's any question that this has had a very serious impact on the Army and the Marine Corps. As you pointed out, we're meeting recruiting objectives by lowering the standards that we had before, giving moral waivers, and what's beyond the mere gross statistics is the fact that we are developing serious holes in our force structure because we can't get the high-skilled people we need for certain of the military occupation specialties. I note that my colleague is a graduate of the military academy. I'm told that of those who've graduated since 2003, when their 5 years are up, we've lost over 60% of them. There's a shortage of captains, a shortage of majors. We're having to accelerate promotions. We're having to promote at a far higher rate than at any time in our history. We are developing a hollow army.
And we're running out of time here, but Colonel Chamberlain, you served with General Zinni as his Inspector General, and he was one of the few military officers to come out against the war before the Iraq War before it started, and he's in many regarded, I think, as quite a hero in many circles, but the question remains is. If, for example, it's true that there's some tension between Admiral Fallon, the new CENTCOM commander, and General Petraeus, what does it mean? Does it mean that the political authorities can always find the political generals will do their bidding, and in the case of General Zinni, no matter how good an officer you are, it doesn't mean you're going to be listened to?
No, well, certainly. Yeah, they'll always be able to find somebody to do their bidding. I mean, that goes without saying. But go back to what General Gard was talking about, the status of the Army. We need to be very, very clear about something. First of all, the 5,000-some-odd troops the President has, quote, you know, sent home early, that's, none of those guys were coming home early. They were scheduled to come home in December. In fact, they were actually scheduled to come home in August, and they've all been extended. So that is not any type of boon or
concession
because we're successful. The other thing is I'm hearing, and I'm in comms with the guys that are over in the box. Reenlistments are down. The troops are saying after the second and third tour, quote, I'm done, and they're not reenlisting. And to go back to something General Guard also said, these moral waivers, that's just tip of the iceberg. We met our recruiting goals this year because we went with two-year enlistments with a $15,000 bonus if you would sign up for 2 years. And we'll give you another $20,000 if you'll go now instead of waiting 30 days after you enlist. And what these kids don't understand what they're getting into, Ian, is they're signing up for 2 years, but they will spend four or more in the Army because of stop loss. Right now, there's up to 70,000 soldiers who are being kept in the Army beyond their terms of enlistment through a program called stop loss. We talk about a draft and not having one. There is a draft, and it's called stop loss. The other point is when we try to refill all the boots on the ground next summer, that's National Guard going big time. The Army's not going to be able to sustain the flow. And if the president and whoever gets elected wants to continue this war in Iraq instead of fighting the real war on terror, they're going to have to go to the draft.
Well, just in closing then, let me have a quick last word from General Guard. I was most impressed by the senator from Nebraska, the Republican senator from Nebraska, who asked some of the toughest questions of General Petraeus, Chuck Hagel, a veteran of the Vietnam War. So, and he quoted the seven NCOs who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. One of them was shot in the head recently. He's apparently not in great shape, and two of them died in a truck accident. And he basically said, are you ignoring the NCOs? Is there a separate universe here between the generals and the NCOs? Because Petraeus is saying one thing, and the guys on the ground are saying quite the opposite. So just in closing, is there this disconnect, and who should we be listening to?
Well, you raised a good point, and I think I should mention that there's a difference between the mission that Petraeus has and the mission that, say, the service chiefs have. The service chiefs are supposed to recruit, train, and provide combat-ready forces. Petraeus is trying the best he can to fight a no-win situation in Iraq, so the more troops he has, the better. The point that was made earlier about these folks between now and mid-July being scheduled to go home is absolutely right, and you're going to have to make some drastic changes in policy to try to keep the troop levels represented by the surge. One interesting point, Senator John Warner, you'll recall, a few weeks ago said, we ought to at least bring 5,000 of them home before Christmas. Well, he's got his 5,000 with 700 to spare, and I don't know if there's a direct connection, but there well might be.
Well, it's I think window dressing at best, but I thank both of you for joining us, Lieutenant General Robert Guard and Colonel E.W. Bill Chamberlain. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Lieutenant General Robert Guard and Colonel E.W. Bill Chamberlain, commenting on the reviewing the selling of the surge on Capitol Hill this week. I'm now speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who is an author, filmmaker, and journalist. His most recent book is License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, which is now out in paperback. And he is currently the co-founder and owner of IraqSlogger.com, which is a 24/7 news service from Iraq online. And he's just back from Afghanistan, where you were in Afghanistan with the from the beginning, after the 9/11, when the U.S. went in there, and then that was, of course, where you discovered the American Taliban, John Walker Lind. Now that you've been back, is it, as many are suggesting, in fact, a narco state?
Well, the first time I went to Afghanistan was 1995, so my historical perspective goes a little further than 2001. I was just in Afghanistan, and one of the things I like to do is just catch up, you know, talk to various players, whether they're drug dealers or the Taliban or whatever. And this time is the first time I've been to Afghanistan in which people have given up on the concept of centralized government and have basically gotten down to business, and that business can be summed up in one word, and that is drugs.
So when the Vice President Cheney this week lamented that there's no Nelson Mandela or Muhammad Karzai in Iraq, maybe he was high. Maybe he was smoking something.
You know, the Karzai government did have a chance. I mean, it was a popularly accepted government. Nobody really dislikes Hamid Karzai, but he still retains his role as mayor of Kabul. And he has been extraordinarily ineffective in resolving some of the problems that they've had, of course, all over Afghanistan, which has always been one of the more poor countries in Southeast Asia. One of the things that I found was very interesting is that the Northern Alliance, the guys that we gave over $60 million to fight the Taliban, have been excluded and ostracized, and they're all in business now. They have sort of titular roles in politics, but they're all busy making millions of dollars in facilitating the movement of drugs through various border regions. So that whole entity has become sort of the kingpins of the narco state. The other thing that sort of blew me away, which is common knowledge, but it's something worth thinking about, the guy everybody points to as the number one narco dealer is a guy named Wali Karzai, which is Hamid Karzai's brother. And I was in a meeting in which a tribal elder had been present, in which the Canadians, who had been taken over Kandahar region, basically went to Hamid Karzai and said, either you do something about your brother or we're going to do something about it. So it's become that tense.
But has anything been done?
There is a process. There is a drug eradication program that is going on inside Afghanistan. It is a token effort, and it is turned also into a business, because when they give a list of how many acres they need to have cleared of poppies, the local governor then gives it out as bids to the various landlords who grow poppy, and whoever pays the least amount of money has his area cleaned. So it's also become a way to make money.
Well, if what we're doing in Colombia is going to be any model, the drug eradication program in Colombia has basically been a boon for the U.S. chemical industry, but it's not doing anything about the supply of cocaine.
Well, we know this spring, the major difference between the Colombian industry, which I've spent a lot of time in the drug fields with the drug dealers, is that that's a push business. The business in Afghanistan is a pull business. And what I mean by that is that you could get on a plane, fly to Dubai, you would order your product either as brown or white. White goes for $3,000 a kilo. Then you would ask, you'd be asked by the drug dealer where you want it delivered, and you'd say, well, Los Angeles, California. He'd do a quick calculation and say that'll be an additional $7,000 per kilo, and he will guarantee delivery to you. You then give him the money. He puts the order in through a Hawala, which is a money transferring firm. The labs load up vehicles that either go through Iran directly to the Turkish border or to Karachi or north into Moscow, and you get your product 4 to 6 weeks later.
And has this, what you're describing seems to be like a kind of FedEx for the drug business, has this system, is this a new phenomenon or has this been an evolving system?
It used to be an archaic phenomenon. Now, the business of drug smuggling wasn't as slick and as large. You know, back in the day, drug smugglers used to get apprehended at the Iranian border, and there used to be all kinds of problems in Karachi. Now the Iranians allow these sort of high-speed convoys of Toyota pickup trucks to drive right through the southern border and go all the way up to the Turkish border without molestation. The ISI, the Pakistanis, guarantee passage.
But that's the Pakistani military intelligence service.
Right. They guarantee passage through Spin Boldak, where the Taliban first started, all the way to the ports in Karachi. And in Karachi, the only difference is that they then mingle the drug with large containers of clothing. In other words, you technically order 10 containers of T-shirts or, you know, some kind of clothing, and the product is then saturated into that clothing and shipped in containers directly to its destination. If it goes the other way to Turkey, it's still kept.
In other words, the clothes themselves are impregnated with
heroin. Yeah.
Heroin, and what do they do when they get to the other end? They wash them out?
Yeah, you're given a certain chemical, and then you soak these clothings. The product rises to the top. You scrape it off. You can also sell the clothing, I guess, at swap meets if you want the extra money. But if it goes the other way, it goes in what they call MAANs, M-A-A-N. These are bundles of plastic, 1 kilo each. And they get directly shipped by truck to to the Turkish border and then into Europe and then into containers. So
they go through Balochistan then?
Yeah, the Baluchis are the main people in terms of running these convoys. But the point being that now the governments of Pakistan and Iran are expediting and facilitating the passage of large amounts of raw drugs directly through their country.
Mostly to Northern Europe, but some to the United States.
Well, Canada's, you know, my friends who run the drug business explained the whole process to me very carefully. Canada is the major North American shipping point. Scandinavia is also the secondary area. Amsterdam is a huge port for shipment of drugs. And then most of it comes by trucks. As you know, Istanbul, you can drive directly into Europe and into all the capitals. Very little shipped by air, but most of it's done by land and sea.
And I guess the suggestion you're making here is, Robert Young Pelton, is that the Iranians, and you mentioned the Pakistanis, they used to cooperate. I know Iran actually had a number of battles with drug dealers on their border. They also fought the Taliban, almost went to war with them. So what are they doing? They're just deciding, well, you guys are out to get us, so we're going to make life miserable for you.
They've controlled it by saying, look, as long as you don't stop in Iran, as long as this massive amount of product goes directly to the Turkish border, we don't care. And obviously they make money as well. Pakistan has done the same thing. Now, there is a major drug problem in Pakistan, not so much in Iran. But Iran, as you said, was used to be very, very vigilant about any type of drug passage through their country because of their religious beliefs. I mean, don't forget that the Taliban, if they took credit for one thing, they essentially eradicated the poppy crop along with the weather conditions that didn't make it feasible.
There's a sanction against it in the Quran, right?
Yeah, well, no, you're not supposed to get high, basically, to make it simple. But the bottom line is that the drug business is a criminal business, and it's a destabilizing business. So if you look at a map of violent incidents, you'll see that the entire southern region is a patchwork of small groups who are basically either protecting areas or controlling areas. All these attacks you see on convoys and private security contractors and infrastructural people is not the Taliban. The Taliban really doesn't exist anymore. It's just a series of patchworks of people who are funded by drug business.
So this war, this resurgent Taliban is in fact resurgent drug lords.
Yeah, but it's a mistake to say the word Taliban. If you drove from Kabul westward across Afghanistan, you would stop and meet about 40 different groups, of which maybe, you know, 3 or 4, 10% would say that we're aligned with the Taliban. But the concept of the actual Taliban, I mean, Mullah Omar is in Quetta. He's not interested in sort of taking over the country of Afghanistan anymore.
So the guys that grab the Koreans are the kind of model you're talking about, right?
Right. There are people who are aligned with the Taliban. In other words, they use that infrastructure for weapons and for money and for funding, but they are not the Taliban. The Taliban, if you remember correctly, were these draconian people who forbid the usage of drugs and the drug business.
Right. Well, given that Afghanistan, Robert Young Pelton, Afghanistan accounts for roughly 90% of the global supply of heroin, and it's the supply has been up 50% in the last 10 years, and you mentioned a lot of it goes to Canada and in the United States, but I think the bulk of it goes to Northern Europe, where there is a serious drug problem. So these countries, NATO members, they must have some motivation to want to do something about this.
Well, surprisingly enough, they have what they call PRTs, Provincial Reconstruction Teams, which is a counterinsurgency model based on the 60s, where you set up a little base in regional areas. And what you're supposed to do is do hearts and minds projects. For example, most of these people, which come from NATO, are only doing intelligence gathering. They're not really mandated with reconstruction or fighting any war or getting involved in the local politics. They're only there to gather intelligence about drug movements. And one particular team, which is a Swedish team, which runs around with their shorts and blonde hair in the northern part, absolutely has no reconstruction goals at all. They're there simply to gather intelligence on the drug business.
And when they do that, what do they do with this intelligence?
Well, they feed it back, of course, to their home governments. But Europe is terrified of this phenomenon because, as you say, Europe is racked with this heroin problem, and it has a large number of expats and, you know, people that move back and forth between Afghanistan and Europe. The U.S. doesn't really seem to have a focus on heroin anymore, or these opiate products. Canada is a gateway for it, but we're not really screaming. We're more interested in meth and crack and things like that.
So if you were to buy this stuff up, the rationale for the Afghan farmer is that I get more money for this crop. I'd be happy growing turnips if I could, but you don't fetch the same price. So if you could buy the stuff from the farmers and put it on the legitimate market, or destroy it, or do whatever, would that be a feasible way to go?
No, I think there's a senseless that's behind that. They want to buy up all the crop and use it for opiates and for medical usage. These people you're dealing with are extremely powerful fighters. I mean, they have anti-aircraft guns, they have truck-mounted weapons, they have large groups of fighting men. The landlords are not interested in selling product to a legal distributor because he has connections through the Iranian and the Pakistani government. Their goals are political. In other words, they're not supporting this traffic in heroin because they care about farmers. They care about it because it does damage to the Western world. One thing I should mention is that, you know, for example, Canadians ship wheat to Afghanistan at a cost of $250 a ton, and yet you can buy wheat on the local market for $200 a ton. So we also have the problem of competing aid organizations and programs defeating the goal of farmers being self-sustaining.
But let me just get this straight there, Robert Young-Pelton. The Pakistanis, who are our allies, and the Iranians, who have obviously had no incentive to help us out in any way because our government has periodically threatened there's a possibility of military action, and more and more the Iraq war is morphing into a proxy war against Iran. So that's understandable why they would want to hurt us, but why would the Pakistanis want to hurt us?
Well, first of all, the Pakistanis are not our allies. I mean, we use them just as we did in the 80s to further our goals, but you have to understand that the Pakistanis are a very vigilant, very hawkish Islamic government. Their goal is to support the Islamic elements inside the Pashtun areas because they don't want to lose Pashtun support. By supporting the drug industry, they are self-funding the support for the Mujahideen and the fighters who are going against the foreigners inside Afghanistan. So it's almost a mini version of what we did against the Soviets, except that money comes directly from drugs.
Well, just in closing then, Robert Young-Pelton, if indeed the second war, the orphan war, you just visited Afghanistan, we're told it's going poorly. It sounds to me, from what you've told us, it's going about as well as our war on drugs is going. So I don't have much hope here. Do you?
No, Afghans are actually depressed because they realize that they had a shining moment that they should have grasped and they didn't. And I mean, when the Canadians ask the Americans to leave the South because they're a destabilizing element, then you know we've got problems. So just expect more problems over the next few years.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert Young-Pelton.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, and journalist. His most recent book is License to Kill, Hired Guns and the War on Terror, which is now out in paperback. And he's currently the co-founder and owner of IraqSlogger.com, which is a 24/7 news service from Iraq. And he's just back from Afghanistan. Let's now go to the subject of the broken government, how Republicans' rule destroyed the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. I'm speaking with John Dean, who before becoming counsel to the President of the United States in July 1970 at the age of 31, was the chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of the Law Reform Commission, and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. He served as Richard Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days. John Dean has written a number of books on a number of subjects, law, government, and politics, and he recounted his last days in the Nixon White House and Watergate in two books, Blind Ambition and Lost Honor. He has authored 8 books in total, including the bestsellers Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, and Conservatives Without Conscience. His latest, already a bestseller, is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches, which I take it is the third in this trilogy, or the conclusion book in the trilogy, John Dean. Let's begin with, in terms of broken government, with the judicial branch, given that Attorney General Gonzalez is actually quitting Monday, but he's pretty much out of there. There's an expectation that the president might have nominated a contentious nominee like Ted Olson, but the word we hear now is that he may name a former federal judge, Michael Mukasey, who apparently has some bipartisan support. So is this the end of President Bush's pugnacity?
I wish. I think it's the beginning of his insight that he's not going to get another attorney general in there. He'll have to have an acting one if he doesn't put somebody a little less partisan, a little less one of his men in that post. And apparently that's the direction he's heading.
Well, in your book, you talk about, let's begin with something that I find extraordinary, is that the Federalists, who have you've written about and have had an enormous impact on choosing the federal judiciary and in particular Supreme Court justices, how do they explain, or if indeed they do explain, the inconsistency with their sort of fundamentalism in terms of original intent of the Founding Fathers with their embrace of the unitary executive, which...
I know. Quite curious, isn't it? As I learned in my last book, Conservatives Without Conscience, consistency is not something that's terribly important to them. In other words, if they like a position and it favors a reason or a pursuit of power that they have in mind, the fact that it doesn't follow the strictures of the Constitution doesn't trouble them terribly at all. And that's, in fact, the bottom line as to why we have a broken government today. As I looked at each of the three branches, it is they give lip service to the Constitution. They talk about how how they follow that document, believe in that document. But when you actually look at their practice, it's something else.
But the sad thing is, and you've made it clear in your chapters on the third branch, towards a breaking point, going back to the nomination and successful vote to make Rehnquist the Chief Justice, you say that Rehnquist repeatedly perjured himself. And apparently nobody really had the courage to step up and nail him on this. In the case of another judicial fundamentalist, Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill's testimony was corroborated, but for some reason or another, Joe Biden folded and they didn't present the evidence they had. And then you've got the cases now of the two, Scalito and Roberts. It's extraordinary to learn that in the case of Sandra Day O'Connor quitting, she apparently went to Rehnquist and said, look, my husband's got Alzheimer's, I'm going to have to leave, but I understand you're going to leave too, and we both can't quit. So if you're going to quit, I'll stay on, but if you are not going to quit, then I'll quit. And he apparently said, well, you can leave. And she did leave, and shortly thereafter, Rehnquist died. And then it turned out, ironically, that
he was good to his word. He just didn't know that there was a bigger situation confronting him.
but the great irony, John Dean, is that and a tragedy too, is that Sandra Day O'Connor's husband, his Alzheimer's suddenly got worse, and he was institutionalized. And she apparently regrets having left the court. She had many years of service she could have given, and she's particularly incensed that she was replaced by Alito, who she has contempt for, who's ruling the writings earlier saying that a woman had to get permission from her husband in order to have an abortion, really stuck in her craw. So it's full of twists and turns and ironies. Feckless on the part of the Democrats, and of course, the weird twists of fate.
Well, as you know, as I described in the book, we've reached literally the tipping point with the court. While yes, the court is conservative, it is so close to going over the line to what I describe as fundamentalist, which would mean that everything from the you can just say goodbye to things like Roe v. Wade and school prayer will be very common. But the most striking thing to me has always been the fundamentalist belief that the Bill of Rights, do not apply to the states. They would only apply to the federal government. Therefore, a state like Utah could have a state religion. A state, let's say Mississippi, could eliminate the need for a warrant for search and seizure. You know, it could just be endless what you could do if you get one more fundamentalist on that court. So this is the thing I think has to be raised in 2008 so voters know how high the stakes really are.
But how did our democracy get this far out of whack? Because the Federalists don't represent a majority of the country, and these views, particularly the states' rights radicalism that you just outlined, is not a mainstream opinion.
No, it's not. They have been very effective. I have studied and looked very closely at how these authoritarian conservatives took control of the Republican Party. They're actually losing some of their cash right now, and they are a little bit less influential, but yet they're terribly powerful. Republicans are fearful that the nominees that are vying for that nomination are trying to attract them to go to the right. The standard quid pro quo to deal with this group has been to give them judicial appointments that satisfy them, and this has been a constant practice really from Nixon on. Why Democrats haven't been more resistant to it, I don't know, but they haven't. And now we're at the point where we have what appears to be four very clear fundamentalist-type judicial judges or justices sitting on the Supreme Court. One more seat. Let's say if somebody, the vacancy came up while Bush is still in office, I think that the Senate would have to take the position that they're not going to fill that vacancy until after the election. But even more important, if a Republican does win in 08, they're going to owe that victory to this base that demands that they appoint another fundamentalist to the court. And that's when this the law of this land will change for decades.
Now, John Dean, there was a suggestion written, an op-ed opinion, I can't remember who wrote it, suggesting that if the Democrats win in 08 or 08 and come in 09, they could, in fact, stack the court as Roosevelt tried to do to reverse this the rightward drift. So is that a practical idea?
Well, it always seems like it, for some reason, is not playing by the rules. This is a very standard Republican thing to do, is to change the rules in the middle of the game. The size of the court has varied over the years. The Congress does have the power to have as many or few as judges or justices as they want. They could reduce the court from 9 to 7. They could go to 12 to 15. They could do anything they wanted to. But I think that the concern is that there would be some sort of backlash from doing that, unless a very powerful case could be made that there's a real need to have a larger court. And that might be a legitimate argument for this reason. The court under Rehnquist started cutting back drastically on the number of cases it would process each year. This has resulted in, also it's consistent with the fundamentalist jurisprudence, to give less and less access to federal courts by ordinary people. Corporations, big corporations, can get in there and get themselves protected, but the average person, even a member of Congress, has no standing anymore to go in and bring a lawsuit against somebody in the executive branch. And there is, this is not what was envisioned by the founders of the country. They thought that the court would look over what the executive branch and the judicial branch and the legislative branches are doing. So a larger court could handle more work, and this could indeed have a very positive impact. So there can be good arguments for it.
But inherent in what you're saying, John Dean, appears to be that the ideological underpinning of the fundamentalists is fraudulent, that in effect, for all of their lofty rhetoric about original intent, at the end of the day, they favor the rich over the poor, the powerful over the alienated, business over labor, and lobbyists over citizens.
They use their originalism as a ruse. And they look at the Constitution and say, well, what the founders wrote is what we have to interpret, and we can't add. If they didn't put it in the Constitution, we shouldn't interpret it. They're the what I call the dead Constitution crowd that doesn't believe this is a living document, and they want to lock it in with late 18th, early 19th century thinking and apply that to the 21st and future centuries. It's absurd.
Again, I'm speaking with John Dean, the author of Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches, the third in a trilogy written by a, what do you call yourself, a former Republican, a recovering Republican, an alienated Republican?
Well, I'm a in California, as you know, we don't declare either party if we take an independent stance, and that's what I am. I'm a non-affiliated voter in California.
See, well, of course, the Republican governor in this state is a somewhat different type of Republican. At least he seems to be even at war with his own fundamentalists.
Yes, he is. Fortunately.
So, I suppose the good news, in a sense, indeed you've made clear in your book that you're alarmed at what's happened, and the hijacking of the Republican Party by religious fundamentalists. The candidates that you mentioned or alluded to earlier that are running for the Republican nomination, the most likely ones, Giuliani, at least the front runners, Giuliani and Thompson. Thompson seems to be a vacuous blowhard, and Giuliani, I think, is very flawed. The one that I think I'd be worried about, who could in fact roll the clock back and even go back to that states' rights scenario you mentioned, is Mitt Romney. He seems to be, of all of them, the most ambitious, amoral. He could almost buy the presidency. So,
well, you know, what's interesting, he actually, I'm told, was a pretty good governor up in Massachusetts. He's something of a chameleon. And now he's, of course, taking a very different stance to win the nomination. I'm not quite sure he knows where he would come out.
But you
which
said
is a little troubling also.
Yeah, but you
because
said
we're not sure what no one would know exactly what they were getting with
sure,
them.
Sure, but you said that their pandering is going to lock them in to this reactionary agenda.
Absolutely. They can't win the nomination without that often just quiet, implicit quid pro quo. If you give me the nomination, I will give you fundamentalist judges.
Well, on the other, some of the other branches of government, particularly the Congress, there's a new sort of tell-all coming out by Alan Greenspan that promises to blow the lid off some of his experiences with his administration. He's quoted as saying, the Republicans in Congress lost their way. They swapped principle for power. They ended up with neither. They deserved to lose. I guess.
Well, he and I are certainly on the same page on that issue. What I explain in my book is how the process actually evolved and how they indeed played one game winning the Congress and a very different game. And really, again, in each instance with each branch, I sort of look at how the Republican philosophy has moved that branch off of its constitutional mooring. And they did that when they were running the Capitol Hill. They did it not immediately, but within two or three years of getting control of the House. They had so changed the House that the deliberative process had vanished. They had brought incivility in as the new form of debate. It was really quite remarkable. And the good news, on the Congress, is that slowly but surely the Democrats are starting to repair the damage that was done during the last decade plus of Republican control.
Except they're not unable to undo the damage done so far in Iraq. And it seems to me that their position is to let the Republicans hang themselves on this war. Bad news for the soldiers over there fighting it and for the Iraqi civilians that are dying in record number. But do you see
it? It's hard to tell whether, you know, clearly they don't have the supermajority needed to override Bush's veto or even to override a filibuster in the Senate. So there's limits to what they can do, even though they control both House and Senate. And I think it's clear what Bush is trying to do is at least stall long enough while he's in office that it doesn't all fall apart on his watch, and then he can blame the Democrats, if they win the White House in 08 and take over in 09, he can say, well, if they had followed my policy, we wouldn't have all fallen apart. And so I think the Republicans are trying their best to pin this on the Democrats one way or the other. If the Democrats did get the power and mustered the strength and brought in enough Republicans to override a veto, Bush would say, whatever went wrong then was their fault. So it's clearly a finger-pointing game, and somebody else he's trying to get bailed out of his mess by pointing to the laying it on the Democrats.
Well, it's true they're inheriting a mess. It's also likely that they may actually win enough. They could even get to, in the Senate, they could even get up to 60, the way things are breaking for them now.
In the 08 election?
In the 08 election,
that is very possible, yes.
But just in closing, John Dean, we're running out of time, but the good news in terms of your book, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branch, is that you end up with a great deal of optimism. I mean, you believe that this situation is reversible.
I do. While I am admittedly a glass half full type person, I've always been convinced that if people have information, and slowly but surely the mainstream media and everybody else is getting this information to the American people about the mess that exists in government and here in Washington, where I am right now. And when they get that information, they do the right thing. My model has always been the jury. You take a number, 12 people from very different walks of life, put them in a room. They have information that they've been bombarded with. They have rules of a general nature to follow, often highly complex questions. You know, they could be a civil conspiracy, an Enron-type complex business situation. It could be just a simple but yet confusing murder case. 99 out of 100 times they make the right judgment. The voter does the same thing. So I'm not worried if the information is out there.
Well, I thank you for adding to the information with your book, Broken Government, How Republicans Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. John,
always a pleasure to join you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with John Dean, who was Richard Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days. He also became the principal witness against Richard Nixon and Watergate, helping to bring him down. He's the author of the bestsellers Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, Conservatives Without a Conscience. And his latest book is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. So I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineers. This program is available at ianmasters.org.